Conciliums with Pete and Charlie.
I'm Pete.
I'm Charlie.
The unity of knowledge.
That and a whole bunch of caffeine is what's going to get us through this. George Carlin was a Renaissance man.
Do you think so?
What is a Renaissance man? We talked about Renaissance engineers a little while ago.
Yeah, I think a Renaissance man or woman.
Should be a Renaissance person. Yeah. Because now that we're past the Renaissance, we recognize...
A person of the Renaissance.
Ooh. And he pronounces it with the French lilt.
But in all seriousness, I think that Renaissance implies...
Rebirth, equal, enlightenment.
Equal skill and interest in arts and sciences, right?
I think that is one of the implications, and I agree with that. I'd like to think of myself as a Renaissance man.
So where is George Carlin's Renaissance? I'm not going to try and pronounce it correctly or even interestingly anymore.
I don't even speak French, so...
Yeah. Where is George Carlin's Renaissance man tendencies, though? Like, I think George Carlin thought a lot about stuff, and I did... You know, I think he was
smart. He
thought
a lot about society.
I think he was a little... I think he was a little performative in his anarchy, and he was kind of a shitbag. You know, if anything is true about the stuff he said he likes, like, I like chaos, I like anarchy, I like anything that fucks shit up. I like, you know, I like it when people are sad. I like it when people have to deal with stuff they don't want to deal with.
He lost his crap toward the end.
Lost his crap? Was right. Come on.
Well, I'm getting ready for the sanctioned Georgia Tech gig. So I'm not saying shit this morning. I might actually slip up and say I'm actually going to say ass on stage tonight, and I'm worried about that. I mean, in the fact, so this is for the ACC Adventure Prize competition.
Sure,
I had a T-shirt made up that says ACC kicks ass in the elements of the periodic table. Because you can't spell ACC without actinium.
Oh, yeah. I have a Nerds Kicks.
Yeah, exactly. So I basically took that shirt that I sell when I'm on the road, and I took carbon and actinium and put it together to make ACC. And I will make the case that the ACC kicks ass, but it does it in things other than athletics. And I'm going to talk about, you know, the nerds. Let's celebrate the nerds.
I want you to stop dodging the question.
Yeah, I guess maybe he did not care so much about science and
but
technology.
But why did you call him that? That's the thing, really.
It's like, because he's not a great right thinker wrong, who has inspired me.
And so that kind of feels like Renaissance.
But technically it's not. But he is a great thinker that has inspired me.
I mean, often people say Renaissance man or woman because someone is erudite and articulate.
And often they say, you're a jerkwad. But I defend you every chance I get.
And wouldn't... When have you heard of someone who is like highly technically trained being called a Renaissance man or woman?
Roald Hoffman would be an example.
But do people call him that?
I do.
You do, but
because he's a Nobel laureate in chemistry,
media,
and a poet.
Like who has? I'm going to Google it and see if
we're going to the Google machine
and see if we can catch like who's the first celebrity?
Google-a-rama, Google Raya. Google Ruski.
I'm going to start with Renaissance man, and then we're going to search for Renaissance woman, and we're going to see who the first person who is, you know, listed in a Google result. You ready? We're doing this
live.
Da Vinci?
I bet $5 on Da Vinci.
We want a current person. Sorry, the first current alive or recently dead person.
Okay.
For instance, I don't think this will happen, but if David Bowie were to happen to show up.
I'm not sure he's a Renaissance man.
I think Brian Eno is, though.
Oh, yeah. Okay, I'll give you that.
Okay. Boom. Searching. A person with many talents or areas of knowledge. Now, that seems a little, you know, polymath. That's who they're calling that. So, there was
like
a movie. Robin Williams was in a movie.
Oh,
is that right?
I saw that. It's a good movie. He was a robot.
Danny DeVito was in... That was
Bicentennial Man.
Danny DeVito
was in a movie called Renaissance Man, and it was actually quite good.
Okay, well, maybe we'll have to watch that. They didn't like that one.
They didn't like Renaissance Man?
Ernst Lieberman Aiden. Well, I don't know who that is, so I'm not going to call that a celebrity.
What's that article? Modern Day Renaissance Man Shares Lesson on Dingleberries.
Why are you stuck on dingleberries?
You know, you sometimes just get something in your brain. There's Da Vinci. Score!
Yeah, there's Da Vinci. But, you know, I'm not noticing anything. There's no names. Oh, this person is a...
You could write Renaissance person lists.
Dude, check it. Look at that.
David Bowie's.
David Bowie's Renaissance Man Legacy.
All right, click
that. In the National Review.
Wow, that seems a little out of place for David Bowie.
That seems kind of intense.
Wow.
Oh, the National Review was eulogized Bowie like in a very seriously respectful way. Crazy.
Oh, okay. So his outspoken comment on free sexuality, maybe.
For Bowie, sexuality was an opportunity for transgressive public self-definition. That's what the National Review does as a pull quote. Bowie felt a need to retain control and to hold at least something back from his audience. Yeah, so Renaissance Man or Renaissance Woman, I think that those are really just placeholders for a person's sense of...
Cool folks?
A good folk, an interesting folk, you know, somebody that...
But would strict conservatives consider Renaissance person a compliment? Maybe not.
I don't know. I mean, they weren't trashing Bowie by calling him...
Right, National Review. That's interesting perspective.
Natalie Shaheen. Don't know who that is. Yeah, I'm not seeing a lot of celebrities being immediately equated with Renaissance man or woman. Took us to Maya Angelou. Yeah, this is not working for me. I feel like Renaissance
so basically
man or Renaissance
your definition
woman
is crapola.
Well, not crapola, but I just don't feel like that. I don't feel like the colloquial way that this is being described, because Maya Angelou and David Bowie are both amazing artists,
mm-hmm.
and were people who were thoughtful and interesting and engaged in the world, mm-hmm. certainly, but there's a lot of other ways to compliment them than to say right. Renaissance, right?
Right, just like you wouldn't call a pure scientist a Renaissance person either.
I would definitely not call them that, yeah.
But someone who dabbles across boundary lines, you would. So I'm going to stick with...
Dabbles or like is... No, I would say...
As engaged across
boundary
lines.
Yeah, deeply engaged.
More than
across.
Dabbling. More than a hobby.
You know, Steve,
but yeah, Roald Hoffman is one of those folks.
Steve Albini is a Renaissance man.
Who is Steve Albini?
So, I mean, this is sort of a joke, but Steve Albini was the mind behind Big Black, a sort of post-punk band. He was a member of Shellac, and he was a member of a bunch of other bands. And anybody who knows who I'm talking about knows that I'm avoiding saying one of his band names, and that's all right.
It's a poopy name, is what you're saying?
It's a bad name. It's a name you don't want to say. Okay. And he is also a very competent and respected recording engineer. So he is the whole package when it comes to being a recording artist.
Would you say Dolby was a similar guy, technology and music?
No, I don't really know much about Dolby.
Okay.
I mean, I know that Dolby is, the name is out there in the world, but I don't really, is this Thomas Dolby?
I think it's the son, right? The son recorded some music, right?
There was a singer who was a Dolby who... All right, I'm putting that in Google. So I'm just learning stuff all the time here.
So now we're doing research.
Very fast surface research. Thomas Dolby. He was an English musician, is an English musician and producer, known for She Blinded Me with Science. Is that who you're thinking of?
Yeah, that's the guy.
Oh,
right,
no.
So producer, but I believe his father was the guy that invented the noise reduction technology.
That seems crazy.
Why does that seem crazy?
Personal life. His father, Martin Robertson, was a professor of classical Greek art and archaeology.
Oh, maybe I have that wrong.
No.
Maybe he was the guy. We're all confused.
Oh, dude, Dolby is his stage name anyway.
Oh.
Yeah. Also, I don't think that an interest in... like, I don't think that the person who runs that Facebook group, I fucking love science. You know, yeah. I don't think of them as somehow deeply trained in science from their public persona of being... interested in the world and intrigued by scientific curiosity. You know, now they may be, this is a almost anonymous Facebook group, I think, still, maybe. Maybe that person is, but let me just erase my chalkboard mentally. Okay. Mm-hmm. the public persona that I know of from the person who runs I Fucking Love Science, mm-hmm. a Facebook group, and probably other social media accounts, it always comes across, we've talked about this before, it always comes across as simply someone who really is wowed by the natural world.
And but who, I think accomplished people can be self-taught.
Yeah, yeah, and loves the artistry of that world. But they don't then talk about their research or talk about their, you know, the stuff they do. Now, I think that that person who runs that account, I think it's a woman, and I think she's now gone more public than she was at first. Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't call someone who's just interested in it mm-hmm. a Renaissance person. You know, like
right.
I've read a whole bunch of books about science and a whole bunch of books about art. Doesn't do it for me.
Right, but
you know what I mean?
I would, for example, call...
Or Thomas Dolby being interested in science and thoughtful about his work does not make him, to me, a Renaissance man.
But I would call...
However, Steve Albini, mm-hmm. right, understands and practices all parts of his... art, including the technical parts that, you know, building
right.
the tools to
right.
create, to
actually
do
practices
his,
them. Yeah.
You know, like he built a studio, you know, to his mm-hmm. specifications. He's learned how to, I mean, I saw someone say once, I wish I could do anything as good as Steve Albini can record drums. You know, he's known for the quality of his work separate from his creative output.
Right. So, but we're going away from the definition of, Renaissance person, someone who is skilled in more than one thing. That's kind of what it said before, right? It has to span two different fields. So it can't just be art. It just can't be science. It just can't be engineering. It's got to span two or more of those fields.
Yeah.
And by that token, I would say Edvard de Bono, who did a lot of work on psychology, lateral thinking. He's an inventor. He's a physician. So he's technically trained, but he sort of gets into the psychology and the creative arts. Arthur Kessler's the same way. This guy's a novelist and then also got into creativity and a lot of quantitative thinking in that respect as well. So we're using Da Vinci as the exemplar, right? Mm-hmm. He was both technical. He thought about engineering and schematics and balances of things, and he thought about the artsy side as well.
In a way, Leonardo da Vinci is just sort of a gimme because his research was beautiful, right? The way he communicated
his
research was beautiful.
Yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that, actually. I think that's a great idea.
And so maybe this is just a prejudice of mine at this point. Like, I think of it as it's got to be research and it's got to be gorgeous. Huh.
Hmm.
Maybe I'm just being a great big tool and, applying my own somewhat slanted personal bias.
But isn't that what we do all the time? We all apply our own personal brand.
Yeah, but...
Are you a Renaissance person?
No. Not
Why
even
not?
Close. Well, I was confronted by my complete lack of Renaissance on Monday, actually.
And
this was Monday, April 4th.
Uh-oh. No Renaissance and me without my dandruff shampoo. I mean, that sounds...
And
kids, don't let this happen to you.
Let me apologize to everyone right now. I think I have allergies. I think I've developed allergies in my life.
I should have taken an allergy pill. Yeah, or I think so we both got the croup. That's what I'm going with.
Probably not the croup. on Monday, April 4th, I interviewed Tony Fast and Nick Bollweg from Continuum Analytics on my show, The North Avenue Lounge. Mm-hmm. And they are dudes who know how to code. And have done, scientific research. I think Nick was an academic. I know Tony was, mm-hmm. Professionally. Right. And they were talking about how they want to approach scientific discovery and scientific data publishing and data analytics. And I was lost.
Okay.
Like, I don't know how to code. I don't even know what I don't
Wait,
know.
You graduated from Georgia Tech with a degree in economics and a degree in science, technology, and culture. You never took a computer science course?
I took a computer science course.
Oh, you just forgot it all.
I think there's a huge difference between taking a computer science course and understanding the principles. And I mean, like, literally the principles. You know, I get it that a computer, reads the language, mm-hmm. applies that, does things to its inputs to give you outputs. You know?
And magically, things happen.
Like, that's kind of how I think of it.
It's magically delicious.
At this point, you know? But, like, I needed a random number generator.
Okay.
On a regular basis, I wanted to take a ever-increasing range of numbers from 1 to whatever. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to be able to just click a button and get those numbers all randomized for me. Plus, if I added new numbers, I wanted it to re-randomize while leaving out things I had cut off already. And what that was for is I wanted to have a schedule of station and studio IDs that I played in my show Lost in the Stacks. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be random and not repeated, you know. And I was getting up into the 30s, you know. There's over 30 studio station
30.
IDs.
All right. Yeah. Cool.
And I just didn't want to repeat, but I was adding them, you know, and I would certainly add before we'd gotten through all of them, right? So I wanted to make it that if I'd played, you know, the first, 8th, and 17th ID, but then I also then added the 35th, that 35 would get put into the randomized list, but 1, 8th, and 17th.
So let me ask you a question. So do you want to repeat all 30 in sequence without repeating them, then re-repeat the 30 in sequence differently without repeating them?
When you say in sequence, what do you mean?
Well, do I want to do all 30 randomized and then do the same 30 again following that all randomized? Or can it just be sort of an infinite thing that we
I wasn't sure. I was sort of figuring it out as I go. I would like it that it would just pop up like this this week, use this one, you know, and that it would always be a long time since each one.
Computers can do that.
Absolutely. And I was thinking, oh, you know what? This will be a great way for me to learn how to code.
Right.
Or to learn more about coding. Mm-hmm. You know, so what I'll do is I'll find out what's the language I should use, and I'll build that. And it'll probably be, what, I thought, 7-8 lines of code. Mm-hmm. And then I realized, I have no idea even how to look up what I'm trying to do.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, I typed a random number generator into into Google to see what would pop up as, you know, like, oh, use this language.
I'm sure
there's
an app on your phone for it.
Well, that's the thing. All the results were people who'd already written something.
Yes. This is something people many, many years.
Every particular requirement I have has already been, you know.
It has.
So I was like, okay, well, I'll just use this and not learn how to code.
There's
today.
One in Excel. I mean.
Sure. Yeah. I don't know how to use any of those things. I'm not clear on how it works.
But it's a data app. If you look up random number generators in Excel, it'll tell you how.
Yeah. But let's slide the.
So forget about coding a Donald Knuth algorithm for linear congruential pseudo random numbers.
What?
You just want to.
What are you doing?
This is a big science.
Yeah?
This has been around for a long time. And in fact, in our humor genome thing, we're trying to randomly mix jokes when we query people. And actually, you don't want random numbers. And actually, scientists are so humble that they don't even call it random numbers. They call it pseudo-random numbers because no algorithm perfectly does this.
Right.
But it's good enough for your radio show.
That's important.
Yeah.
Good enough is you know, what I'm trying to do because I don't need to replicate results. I don't need a control group. I don't need to be audited and have it be precise. I just want something to kind of take the... take the tendency towards using sevens out of my, you know, just randomly pick a
Yeah, and that is a problem. When my advisor was doing his PhD work, he found on the old IBM computers, the random number generator had a glitch, and it would sort of tend to repeat something every sixth number, which for you, you might not even notice it.
Yeah, but, and you can't use that for a model. You can't use that for,
but if you're trying to do what's called Monte Carlo simulations, it's a problem.
What,
and what
that,
you
gambling?
Want is you don't want. No, he was actually doing polymer physics. It's not as exciting as gambling. But
is it Monte Carlo? Isn't that a?
Oh yeah, Monte
casino?
Carlo means, you know, the roll of the dice. Yeah. You're using a random number generator to generate the distributions to see when you change parameters how things go. But you actually don't want random numbers. You want, I forget the name of that distribution, but you want something that will tend to not repeat. That's a different type of sampling, and that samples more broadly, and it's actually better for what you. So, for example, if you do, you know, number six, right, promo number six, you want to reduce the probability that promo number six will repeat. That's a finite probability. You can get three sixes in a row. You'd like to eliminate that, and that's just a slight tweak to your number generator. All that is understood.
Yeah.
So,
but I don't know how to do it.
Oh, okay.
I mean,
that doesn't make you a bad person.
I think it does, actually.
I don't know how
days.
To ride a horse. Does that make me a bad person? Have you ever ridden a horse?
Have I?
I know nothing about astronomy. I can barely find the Big Dipper.
I don't think I've ever ridden a horse.
I'm allergic to them, so that's my excuse. But, yeah, I'm not a true polymath. I haven't done everything.
You know, there's a deep well of regret in me when it comes to the world I have not.
Sounds like a Faulkner novel. Yeah. There's a deep well of regret in me.
When it comes to the things I don't know how to do. And
then I ran over the school children in the crosswalk.
Do,
you know? Are you going to be okay? Should we have somebody follow you after the show?
Doesn't someone follow us every time? Have you seen the
guy in
the black coat? I think there's a
drone hovering above.
and if not, there should be,
ladies and gentlemen.
Do you know what I'm talking about, though? Do you know this deep well of regret? This sense that there's so much of experience in the world that you're not going to
I am awash in
apart.
A deep well of regret. I'm drowning in a well of regret. But you just got to get over it and realize that, hey, I've experienced some cool stuff, probably more than the average bear.
Okay. Now, let me explain. It is not that. It's not some kind of, oh, I'm missing out on that regret. It's not that, oh, I regret everything I didn't do. Because I am of the opinion that it's easier to regret something that you have done than you haven't done is bullshit.
Oh.
That's total crap.
Okay, I would agree with you on that.
That is a shorthand for fuck it.
I don't regret having never tried haggis. I can live without that. My daughter had it. She's the chair of the cuisine committee in International House. She said it's actually quite good.
So moving on
okay.
from the stuffed stomach. what were we talking
Pause
about?
Pause for nausea?
Yeah, right. This is
we were talking about your deep well of regret. Are you going to turn
morning.
This into so a cereal?
We're both allergied, yeah. right? We're both tired.
But we are pushing through.
Yeah, sure. That's what we're doing.
And for those of you that have not visited Georgia in the spring, it's not so much allergies as it is
just the actual particular
colloidal
suspension
of pine pollen clogging up the planet. I mean, it's just.
I mean,
we're verklempt.
I think about how you look at pollen counts and they say, you know, very high pollen counts are what, 200, 300?
And yeah, we're in the many thousands.
Is that parts per million? Or
probably.
Yeah. And then Atlanta's like 11,000.
Yeah.
I had a joke and I lost it. What was I talking about?
But if you were a Renaissance man,
I would have kept it.
You'd have instant recall.
In a beautiful leather bound notebook. No, I don't regret the things I haven't done so much as I regret having the quality in me that just wants to not be bothered. You know, like just back off, man. I got my own thing I'm doing.
But you're not that way. You take on too much, right? We were talking about this before the show.
In some very narrow fields. I mean, like, you know, in like very small. Like, I'll do anybody's podcast, and I've you know, trying to produce another one, and I'm already doing far too much. But I also, like, there's tons of stuff that I just won't do. Someone says, hey, are you interested? And I'm like, no.
Like, give me an example.
Of which?
Of something you won't do.
There was a.
And does it involve latex rubber?
A committee. There's a committee that just started to work on how the folks in the library will all stay connected, even when they are dislocated. Right, the
right.
building's being renovated.
Basically, dislocated, moved to different locations, not physically torn apart.
Well, yeah, I hope that you wouldn't think that. We're not gonna torture librarians just because we're taking the books out of the building.
Although I bet that could be a good primetime series.
Ugh, probably late night. Wouldn't you say? Maybe
yeah,
an HBO special.
Right. HBO. right after Nikki Glaser's Not Safe.
So I am not joining that. And I was asked twice. And I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. You know,
You're taking on too
I
much.
Was asked
Good
to do subject liaison work in music technology,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty cool.
Actually, that would be good for you.
It's pretty cool, right? But I was like, I have too much. I cannot do anymore.
Okay.
So there are a few things that I'm compelled towards that I will
right.
overwork myself on.
Right.
But not everything. I'm not like,
but
yeah, I'll do
okay.
this, I'll do that, I'll
a
do
A lot
that.
Of really successful people are much more hyper-focused than you are.
Well, I used to say, all I want, the only thing I need to be happy is a comfortable chair, a cup of coffee, and a book. And it should be a good book. But, like, that's it. And I would be happy wherever that particular thing is.
A man of simple needs. New this fall on CBS.
A little bit. I was like, hey, do you want to go in a cabin in the woods? I'm like, sure. Can I just sit and read? It's like, no, we're going to, you know, have a fire pit and a cookout. And we're going to go for a run and we're going to hike. And I was like, no.
Well, you can also read. I like to do all those things.
I'm just saying, you know, the only point of a vacation to me these days is to be somewhere where you cannot be found.
Oh, I agree with that.
So that you can sit and read. Like, that's what I think is important.
Yeah, I don't do that, though. I brought my laptop on my my honeymoon.
Well, that was your mistake.
Yeah. And that set the tone. Any day now, my wife's going to set the bed on fire while I'm in it and collect the insurance. Who could blame her, you know?
No one in this room.
Right. Including me. Honey, did you hear that? I'm actually agreeing with you.
So maybe what we're really saying for this podcast is that we've both gone terribly wrong. We've made huge mistakes and we need to recover from them.
And we are drowning in a deep well of regret.
Well, what do you think about that, Pete? Do you think that's true?
No, I think what keeps you from hurling yourself in front of the oncoming train.
Are you talking to me or just in general?
Just in general, both of us, is trying to get over that deep regret. Everyone has that deep regret. That's
you think
a common
so?
Thing, yeah.
I see people out there walking around like they have no regret. I mean, they piss me off, but
they're
they
frauds.
Seem to be out there.
They're liars. No, it's just, you just that's what I'm saying. You have to do the best you can and try to be upbeat about all the
There's
crap that happens
to you. There's people out there who have swagger.
You don't have swagger? You look pretty swaggy when you...
When have you ever seen me swagger?
I don't know. I'm not watching your ass usually, so... I wouldn't know.
Swagger's in the shoulders, is it not? Sway
I don't know
is
where
in the ass.
Sway? I have regret about this entire podcast now.
I'm kind of digging it, actually. I feel like we're starting to get somewhere.
No, what, no, but people regret? With swagger, no. A lot of people with swagger, it is hollow. It is, they're just arrogant. Donald Trump has swagger. And I disagree with just about everything that comes out of his mouth.
Okay, let's talk about that real quick. Is his swagger hollow, or is it true, and he's just kind of seemingly an awful person?
Yes, he's an awful person.
Right. But
yeah, I think
swagger,
he actually believes it. You are
his swagger's real.
You are reflective enough to understand that you don't have the answer to every problem.
So it
on
would
the
seem
planet.
That reflectiveness is actually a poor trait.
No, because it keeps you honest, right?
Who needs honesty? I mean, if honesty is what makes
like
me
honesty.
Have a hard time to get out of bed in the morning and be like, oh, just lay my head against the steering
this
wheel before
I get
out of the car.
This is the nature of your tortured existence. It's another Faulkner novel. It was the nature of Charlie's tortured existence.
You know, someone called
somebody should be writing this shit down.
Someone called me. We're recording it.
What
someone
call
called
you?
Me a font of... nihilistic optimism or optimistic nihilism.
All right, I gotta disassemble that. What do I have to do to that one?
Unpack. What you want to do.
Okay, see, you are technical.
Oh, so shut it's like the fuck up.
It's a data condensed zip file. Okay, a font as in spewing forth.
Yes, this was he described me in high school as a person who was full of, and I wish I remembered which
I don't
order,
think you're nihilistic.
But I'm just saying this was at the time.
Well, in high school, we're all douchebags.
Nihilistic optimism or optimistic nihilism. And I don't, what? Why did I even bring that up? What did you say? Oh, right, Trump. Yes?
Yeah, Trump.
And it seems
or
like...
Drumpf, as his original
name. Yeah, make
him
Drumpf again. Yeah. It seems like that's a bad quality. You know, nihilism, kind of in any form, is bad, even if it's optimistic.
Yeah.
And optimism is terrible in any form, especially nihilistic.
But you're not nihilistic. I think you believe in some basic set of moral,
ethical
values.
You're going to let my stab at optimism just go right by? You don't want to engage that?
Well, you're not very optimistic today, but I'm going to chalk that up to severe allergies. No, I'd say you're upbeat. I mean, you're a little like Eeyore, and so am I. We're like, we're never going to make it. But but you are excited about new things. You're excited about, you know, how to engage people on the pursuit of knowledge through the institution formerly known as the library.
I'm excited about new things in a very narrow range. Like, that gravitational waves thing, remember?
Yeah.
Remember when that came out, and I was like, nah, whatever. Like, that was not just for the podcast. I sort of pumped it up for the podcast so mm-hmm. I could be like point counterpoint. Mm-hmm. But like, I kind of don't care.
Well, it doesn't immediately affect your life.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And I'm very narrow.
And neither did relativity at the beginning of the 20th
century. I'm very narrowly focused right now. And I also am cool with leaving a lot of the theory up to other people.
Right.
You know, who are like in 50 years, something that happened right now in 50 years will be effective in the culture, mm-hmm. will be sort of throughout the world. Right.
Right.
But right now, who cares? Whatever. Work on it. Do your own thing. Don't ask me to be all, ooh, gravitational waves. That's amazing.
But would you vote to fund big physics experiments?
No.
Okay.
I would not. I would vote to put money in a pot that would fund experiments and then trust that it would go out into the world. But I don't want to be in a position to vote on what kind of stuff gets funded.
Oh, no, that's I don't mean what kind of stuff, but would you vote to fund fundamental science, which we're doing less and less of here in the United States? The burden's being shared more internationally, which is a good thing.
Don't push your politics on me, Pete.
But if you actually look at the ratio of what we spend on big science versus big the
pharma.
Arts.
Big pharma.
No, we spend a lot of money on big pharma. But let's face it, that's the title of another podcast. We love the drugs.
Isn't
the drug-oriented
the National Endowment for the Arts, isn't it like it's like
peanuts compared to the National Institutes
of
Health
grants, you know, or something.
And even the National Science Foundation, which is not as big as people think.
Pocket change, you know.
Yeah.
George Soros,
but
as
a scientist, I am a big believer.
Could fund it out of what they lose.
Yeah, in
a
the round off dust of their, you know, of their businesses.
Pete,
but I believe in that.
Pete, hold that thought. Stop it. We're not using that.
You know you are.
Hey, Pete, hold for edit. So So the reason that we got off on this little tangent, right was because I talked to these coders,
right,
who are also scientists, you know, and
okay.
And it's a realm that I got nothing, you know, and in fact, I think that my main problem is that I'm unable to construct a narrative for myself to understand it. Like, I talk to a programmer or a coder or a developer or whatever you call them, and I get the sense like, oh, okay, so you are composing code to make machines do things that are necessary for other things to work.
Yeah, and it sounds like they're analyzing data.
Yeah, but isn't that, aren't they writing tools to analyze data, right? And so they know what they're trying to accomplish, and so they're writing it to make it happen. But, like, what, do you sit down and, you know, when I cut a radio show together,
mm-hmm.
Either we go by a script, and it's just recording it, and you take out the, you know, you bleep the fucks, or you take out the gaps and the, you know, the moments where you cough into the microphone, stuff like that. Or whatever you just said there during that pause.
Or one of these.
Yeah. Right. Or compositionally, you can approach it as you know, an assemblage of clips. Mm-hmm. And then you're like moving stuff around. And then it's like painting, you know, where you're making things happen by the adjacencies of sounds and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So those are two ways of creating and recording that I know about. And right. I don't have any sort of broad metaphors for coding, for development.
Ah, okay. Yeah, so I am not a computer scientist, and I don't do code a lot of applications, but I do. I'm literally teaching a course on coding some of these numerical analytical techniques. So,
what is coding?
Coding is just writing instructions that tell a computer what to do.
Okay.
Now, the nice thing is that computers can interface out to other objects. So, for example, you can use them to sample your world, and you can use them to make things move and change. So now with microprocessors, and this used to be called embedded computing, where we had things inside cars and machines. But now with things like the Arduino controller board, that's a chip.
I've heard about that.
And even the Raspberry Pi, which is a full CPU, you can program these things in tiny little things for not a lot of money to get your computer to tell your world to do everything from turn the lights on and off in a particular sequence to control robots to control machines. And this is something I'm very interested in, and I don't know how to do it, but because I do code and because I have interface computers with other things. I at least understand how they communicate and how they tell machines what to do.
Did you learn to code because you had to do it, because you had to get like you do modeling, right?
Yeah, I did what you did when I was an undergraduate. Everyone has to take a computer science course, even when I was in school.
Yeah, but my computer science course was like, what, 94, 95?
Mine was 80-something.
Yeah.
but I loved it. It was one of my favorite courses, and that's why I ended up going into computer modeling and computer simulation. Now, the nice thing is, back when I did it, it was not very common, but the modern world is driven much more by computation, computational modeling, and big data analysis, which is part of computational modeling. So the modern engineer, scientist, even Renaissance people will design things, we like to say in silico, meaning inside the silicon chip, right? As opposed to, I guess, what, in vivo with the living.
Jesus.
I don't know. I just thought I'd bring in a cool Renaissance term there to make it sound like I'm cooler than I actually am. So it's really big. For example, the new 787 and the Airbus 380 were designed to a large degree in computers.
Yeah.
You eventually have to build it and test it because the models aren't perfect, but the models are so much better now than they were several decades ago. And I got to tell you, a really great example of this was a movie I saw recently with Helen Mirren, Eye in the Sky. Have you seen that yet?
No, and I don't think I will.
Yeah, it's about using drones to do your dirty work.
Yeah.
And they had some really interesting models of casualty estimates, which probably had some very interesting math that goes into them. But now we even estimate, you know, how many people are going to get killed when we drop a Hellfire missile on something. We model everything now because computers are so fast and so good that we can do that. But what are your friends doing with analytical data, you said, the guys you interviewed?
They're figuring out how to condense storify or, you know, create a narrative around the data. I don't know the precise words, but they're, you know, how to make it manageable, right? So the amount of data that's created,
right, lots of it,
you know, in a moment, in a day,
because now we record everything.
Yeah, we can now.
Computers,
we can
are big
record
enough and
everything.
Fast enough and have enough, yeah, storage capability to do that very thing.
One of the examples they used was you know, with a Fitbit, now you suddenly know how many steps you took.
Yeah,
you know. And like deciding what data should be kept, what should be used, what can be crunched, what's useful for understanding, you know, the larger, mm-hmm, the larger scope of your, say, research or your life, you know, yeah, or your physical activity or whatever, right? So that's what they're doing.
But what I like about what you just mentioned is they're trying to distill it to a narrative.
Yeah, because they want to talk about describing scientific research and describing science,
yeah,
in terms that are almost universally understood.
I like it because basically you want to describe it for people that can't read the Matrix raw,
right?
Or as we like to call them, normal. And I realized when I was teaching yesterday, and I'm going to try to write up a second handout for my students. I'm trying to teach them a rather advanced data analysis technique called principal component analysis. And it, you know, I showed him an old test question. We're reviewing for the tests next week. So I put up, you know, half a dozen old tests. You know, here's, you know, there's at least two questions from every topic we're going to do. Look at these. Some have the answers. If they don't have the answers, come into the review session or put it online. I will show you how we got the solution. There's nothing transparent about it. But I took one of my questions on this and had this big MATLAB output on breaking things up into orthogonal vector space and things like that. And I realized I'm looking at this thing, I'm reading the Matrix raw,
right,
and my students,
yeah,
are like, huh? So there's lots of data analytics. You can take data, you can look for correlations, you can look for patterns, you can do advanced linear algebra factorization techniques. And by the way, they do this for everything from eHarmony.com to Netflix, to figure out the next video you want to watch or who you should be, you know, dating. But people don't understand numbers and correlations. They don't read the Matrix raw. They would like a narrative that
there's
tells them
what it
means.
There's got to be an equivalent of the raw matrix, you know, for most people, things that they can read.
It's literally looking at, you know, the covariance matrix. When I look at it, to me, it jumps. I can see what it's saying.
If you want
other people, it's just screwing up.
If you want to get totally separate from, you know, computers, right? Like it's almost, you could say that, a fisherman, right? Who can look at a river and say, oh, you know, This fast-moving water is probably the right temperature for this kind of fish that I'm going to get, and I'm going to put the right fly on or whatever.
Right.
And as anyone who fishes now knows, I don't.
Okay.
I don't know anything about fishing. But reading the natural conditions, reading the, you know, if you're, if you, you know, say a doctor just sort of does a holistic kind of check, like, oh, you know, I'm looking at you, and, you know, and she says, let me see your fingernails, let me see your...
Right.
We see the whites of your eyes. You know, oh, you've got a mineral deficiency or something.
Right.
You know, this kind of, that's reading the matrix in a way.
Right.
Right?
It is. But what's nice is what big data allows us to do is look at huge amounts of data for the, you know, the stream conditions, the you know, the barometric pressure, the temperature of the water, the velocity of the water, and then correlate that with the number of fish that were taken in that particular day. And then suddenly patterns emerge.
Mm-hmm.
And the pattern might say that, hey, the water temperature is really irrelevant. Right? It only depends on either this factor or a combination of these factors.
Oh, my God. Is this econometric analysis?
No, absolutely. Right? Yeah. So you can do it for any of these things. Now, the data is misleading. If you've looked at econometric analysis, right? Because sometimes you don't have a complete data set.
It's really fun to say, well, what if we take this value out? Look, nothing changes. And what if we take this one out? Oh, everything changes, which is sort of a...
Models are sensitive.
It's kind of a magic trick in a way, because you're like, look, you know, here's the thing. But it doesn't...
But if you use it just to make your point, you can make the models do anything. And this is what the book Lying, or the movement Lying with Statistics.
Lies, meant. Damn lies, and statistics. Is that what you're implying?
But if you're honest about it, the best you could do is sort of look at patterns that might be good indicators. For example, I work with John Leonard. John Leonard analyzes a lot of the data on student performance and graduation rates. And there's only a few things that are really good predictors of whether or not you will graduate successfully from Georgia Tech. And it's like some combination of a few scores in preliminary math courses and a, you know, your ACT, SAT score or something like that.
And the number of steps you take in a day.
Right. And it could be. And if someone found out that your Fitbit output actually correlated with that, that would be interesting to do. Believe it or not, it's Georgia State that is analyzing how you perform in your initial classes.
Now, why, believe it or not, that was a little bit of a, that was a dig.
Oh, no, I didn't mean that. I mean, so really, I'm just mad because Georgia Tech, you know, one of the premier technological institutes, I came in this morning to the studio and the door wasn't working. So I'm just angry at Georgia Tech. No, so I shouldn't say, believe it or not, Georgia State is doing fabulous work.
ID to get into the station.
Yeah, Georgia State is doing fabulous work correlating this and identifying students that are in trouble. And furthermore, they then turn that over to the guidance counselor who does translate it into a narrative of you may be in trouble in this area or a different area. And that's connecting it to the people. So all this data analytics is only as good as your ability to find a pattern that can help people do things better.
Yeah.
And that's the narrative. And that is something that those of us that read The Matrix sometimes forget about. I got to write a joke on that. So I was in class the other day reading The Matrix. But it really is. My students were looking at this problem with a little bit of MATLAB output, and it was like they were looking at binary numbers in green cascading down the street to cascading down the screen, just like The Matrix.
Well, you know what I see, though, right?
What?
This is Consilience with Pete and Charlie, a podcast about the intersection of science and the humanities.
The unity of knowledge. I always like to say that part.
You can find us on Facebook, you can subscribe to us on iTunes, and you can always get in touch with me or Pete if you look on Twitter and other social media.
And can't you also find us on Tumblr at peteandcharlie.tumblr.com?
Thank you.